Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country.
And then this tablecloth is new. It's a gift to the White House from the firm of Porto. And it's all embroidered in gold to match the centerpiece and the knives and forks. I want
to tell you how. It is the Live Savage Nation. Today we have a smackdown between Michelle and Jackie. Play it a little louder. I can't even hear it. I think I'm going down. It is the Savage Nation Live. Now, Michelle is in Europe with her husband, whatever his name is. I've forgotten already. Is it Barry, Barack, whatever. Whatever works. And, of course, the leftists in the media are trying to make her into another Jackie Kennedy before she's uttered so much as a paragraph, let alone a word. But they were two different women. When Jackie Kennedy lived. The chrome was thick and the women were straight, as I've said many times. And we had a charming, elegant first lady who impressed the entire world with her grace and charm. So, for a brief segment today on the Savage Nation, I'd like to compare and contrast Michelle versus Jackie. For example, Jackie Kennedy exuded pride in America, while Michelle Obama said the first time she was proud of America was when her husband started doing well in the polls. Jackie Kennedy was raised to be a socialite, while Michelle Obama was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. In this corner, we have 5 feet 7 inches tall, weighing in 120 pounds, Jackie Kennedy. In that corner, we have 5 feet 11 inches tall, weighing in 137 pounds, Michelle Obama. And who will be remembered as the better role model for the girls and young women of America? I will let the Savage Nation decide. We can call about that if you'd like. Or if you don't think that's interesting, I have something quite interesting for you on the Savage Nation. You do know that Bernie's boat goes bye-bye. The bull was confiscated in Florida. The truth is, though, used yachts today are near worthless. You can just imagine what that pig is worth. It's all a window dressing. The government seizing Bernie Madoff's boats, big deal, window dressing. Why don't they seize his apartment? And why don't they seize Ruthie's jewels and assets and the boys Mark and Andrew and the grandchildren, their assets? Forget the window dressing. Typical government window dressing. Recently, I was in South Florida, by the way, speaking of Bernie Madoff and speaking of boats, and I went into an antique store, used furniture, used this. I told you my dad was in a business, so once in a while I love to go into consignment shops. You don't know what you're going to find, particularly in South Florida today. You could find anything. It was mainly dreck. It's sad you go in those stores, you see tables and chairs that your grandmother must have had. They look like funeral home, sad. You could see they had candy on it and that kind of thing. I don't mean they're bad people, but I found something you're never going to believe, which I bought and brought home to my studio. It's a life ring from the British warship, the HMS Sheffield. Now, it looks like an original. I'm not going to ask the antique guy if it's original. What do they know? It looks to me like it is because it's not plastic, and it's an original life ring from the British ship HMS Sheffield. And this is interesting. Would you stop ringing in here? Interesting. In the studio, ringing, dinging, things going on, like around the clock. So I bought the HMS Sheffield life ring. I paid very little money for it. And then I bought a wooden wheel from an old ship. I know I can tell it's an old ship wheel, not a repro. I put it in my studio. My studios look like old bars in North Beach used to look. Artifacts, things hanging from the ceiling, from the walls, on the floor. It's a place that's, it reflects my interest. So, does anyone know who the who sank the HMS Sheffield and when. Whoever does wins a free copy of Psychological Nudity when it is available. Right now we're sold out. We're taking back orders. Would you believe I went through the second printing without anybody appearing on Oprah Winfrey or Good Morning America? And I'm going to print another edition. It's actually being printed, but if you want a copy, you have to do a back order. If anybody knows who sank the HMS Sheffield and when, and you can get on the show and do it, 1-800-449-8255. You know, it's interesting. I'll tell you why it's interesting. Then I ate in a Cuban restaurant recently in South Florida. I got to tell you something. So I go in this Cuban restaurant, small family joint. I had an unbelievable go, about $8.95. I had a piece of grouper fish broiled. I had plantain. They have a sweet one. I said, make it regular. Wait, it gets better. The rice, the beans. And the beans are much better than in the Mexican restaurants, I'm sorry to tell you. I don't know what it is, but the Cubans do it better. In the dish, a plate of garlic, chopped garlic. I didn't have to ask for it like it was some secret, bomb. And chopped onions. I thought I found my homeland. But you know what struck me the most about this Cuban restaurant was a poster that the guy had in the window. It said, Family History. And it shows a picture of the whole family, all the girls, all the boys, grandmother and grandfather. And listen to what it says on the bottom. Our deepest gratitude to our loyal customers and this beautiful country for allowing our family to pursue our dreams. So I had to go up to the owner, and I said to him, you have a beautiful family and a beautiful family story, and I got to tell you something. It's nice to see. I said, compared to so many of the immigrants who come in today who have the wrong attitude, he said, you're 100% right about that. Now, here's something interesting. In the family history, it says, Mariel Boatlift, 1980, 126,000 Cubans abandoned their communist island in a massive exodus. And this family was one of the families. What you don't know is that the communists and the American media made you think that all of the Mariel Boatlift Cubans were criminals. But 99.9% of them were decent Cubans who lost their businesses, lost their homes to the son of a gun murderer, Castro, the Castro killers. And it is true that Fidel Castro, to poison the well of the decent Cubans who fled the island in the 1980, to poison the well and make Americans think all the Mariel boat people were criminals, he threw criminals out of the prisons so that everyone in America would say they're all drug dealers. You have no idea how powerful the communist lobby is in the American media. You think everyone from the Mariel Boatlift was a drug dealer. 99.99% were people like you who are terrified of what's coming to this country. And if you think Castro was not related to Obama politically, you are mistaken. Our deepest gratitude to our loyal customers in this beautiful country, it says, for allowing our family to pursue our dreams. What a beautiful, beautiful thing that is, huh? Anyway, that's the difference here. Do we have a winner yet? Bingo! I think we have a winner on the Savage Nation. He's actually wrong. Dave in Norfolk, Virginia, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, wasn't it Bismarck and at the beginning of World War II?
Well, I'm not certain if that was... Are you saying there was an original Sheffield and a copy?
Well, the HMS Bismarck, Sheffield, was one of the first ships sunk by the Bismarck, I believe.
Well, the actual Sheffield that I am thinking of was the 1982 British ship when the HMS Sheffield was hit by an Argentine missile fired from a fighter bomber.
Right, I'm sorry, I may be thinking of the wrong...
I think you're thinking of the HMS Hood that was sunk by the Bismarck and went down with almost all men aboard.
Yeah,
I made the same. When I bought this life ring in the antique store, I thought of the Hood also till I said, wait a minute, what am I talking about? It wasn't that, but thanks for the call. I made the same mistake. And it makes sense because I bought the life ring in South Florida, and I said, wait a minute. It must have come from someone from Argentina who picked up the Sheffield's life ring when it sank, you know, in the islands down there. In the Falklands Islands, and then sold it to, who knows, to an antique bum, and the antique this, that. Yes, no, we have the winner already. No more calls in it. That way I save a free copy of the book. The HMS Sheffield was a British ship sunk in 1982 by an Argentine missile fired from a fighter bomber, and I have the life ring from it. How much do I have for this life ring? How much do I have? Do I have $50? Do I have $50? One of these days I'll auction off all of the flotsam and jetsam that I bought around the world and raise it for a good cause, but not today. I'm keeping it. I love it. But if you want to talk about the media and Michelle Obama, You can call me at 1-800-449-8255. And if you think this is going to be a light show and you're not going to get agitated, you may be wrong. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country.
Cheers. There are three of them in this room, the two behind us here.
Yes, these two are on loan from the Boston Museum of Fine Art. All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years. And then the most famous one of all is this one of Abraham Lincoln, which traditionally always hung in the state dining room. Healy was a contemporary of Lincoln, but he only saw him once. So he painted this picture from photographs.
See, now that was a first lady who was imbued with the history of the United States of America and proud to speak about it. I just pray to God that the Obamas don't take down the pictures of Lincoln and such and replace them with, Malcolm X. I don't know what's coming next in this White House, to be honest with you. And you say maybe I'm being facetious. I'm not being facetious. You know where I stand on this whole issue. Putting aside skin color, do you think Michelle Obama has the class of Jackie Kennedy? And I want no racial discussion. The fact of the matter is, there are comparisons that could be made. After all, Michelle is no, slouch. She did go to Princeton. And while Jackie went to Vassar and GWU, Michelle did go to Princeton, okay? But as I said, Jackie Kennedy was raised to be a socialite, while Michelle Obama was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. And while Jackie Kennedy was wooed by foreign dignitaries, so far as I can see, Michelle Obama has been booed by foreign protesters. So, you decide. When they were alive, the Kennedys, they were living in another world. It was a world, as I said to you before, where when the chrome was thick and the women were straight, sure. But it was also a world when liberals like her husband, JFK, had the guts to stand up to foreign tyrants, which I don't see happening thus far from this band of progressives. And it was a world where women were respected even if they didn't stand up and give speeches to gay and lesbian groups and anarchist groups, as Michelle Obama has done. So I, you can compare and contrast, but I'm not very impressed with Michelle thus far. 1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com. Houston, Texas. Tony, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike. Great on you, man. Thank God for you. I wish there was more like you out in our nation.
I do, too. I have to agree with you on that.
I'm sorry?
I have to agree with you on that.
Yeah, and I know you can typically say you don't deserve the praise, but you really do. I mean, you really do. But I was just wondering, what would it take to get you, yourself, someone like you in mainstream media without this biased, one-sided reporting that
it's impossible, totally impossible. It is impossible for Michael Savage to ever be accepted by the midstream media. Anyone you see on television should not be distrusted, should not be trusted. It's like Abby Hoffman said, it's like the radicals used to say in the 60s, don't trust anyone over 30. I would say don't trust anyone on television.
Well, it's...
How can you trust anybody who's cleared the gatekeepers of any of the television networks or any of... We know that. But even of the television cable channels, how can you trust these people?
I can't trust them.
I mean, look, I'm sure some of them are good people and love the country as much as I do, if not more. I don't want to wrap myself in a bigger flag. But the fact of the matter is, you have to ask yourself why the Leprechaun failed in radio. I mean, why did the Leprechaun fail in radio, and why is he such a super success on Fox Cable? There are answers to that question. He reads a teleprompter, number one. He's a good deliverer of teleprompting, and there's no question. But when it came down to actually speaking on the radio without someone crossing her legs and putting on lip gel, or whatever they use these days, I mean, the people, they heard it, and they said no to it. It was in the yet. It was hands down. It was thumbs down on him.
Yeah.
So I don't trust anybody in the cable media, frankly. I don't enjoy it anymore. I don't watch it anymore. Thank you for the call, but I really do appreciate the compliments. 1-800-449-8255. New York City, WOR. Tom, you're up in the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm going to pop. People like me are going to pop in America because since, like, 1999, every American president, not that many, 1999, they started to go annually to G20. Effigy, repeat, effigy has been burnt on a stick like Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn fishing in the Mississippi.
Right.
Burnt on a stick. Now, all of a sudden, Barack, our president, goes to Europe, and not one photograph, not one video clip on any network, on any cable show, anywhere can you find a picture of an effigy of Barack Obama on a stick, like Huckleberry.
Oh, but there are protests against the G20 meeting, but you're saying not against our supreme leader.
Well, they're probably there, but I doubt if anyone's going to have...
Well, of course, but and also you're not going to see the pictures, that's for sure, but, I mean, our supreme leader is there.
But why would they not...
Why is he visiting the Queen? Why would he give her an iPod when she already had one? Why is Obama visiting the Queen? What's that all about, to show that they're... I don't get that part of it. What's with the Queen job? I have to go to Henry Kissinger for the inside story on that one. Remember that guy at the airport who claimed that Kissinger and the Queen were drug dealers? Who is that nut who's in jail now?
No idea.
Anyway, I'm not into the effigy thing. I got something that'll get you sick. You know, I'm a supporter of the police. I spent 6 days supporting the four officers and their families. You gave money, I gave money. Our hearts were broken. Herman gathered in a church Tuesday to say goodbye to the cop killer. Now, you have to read the whole story written by the vermin who write for the San Francisco Chronicle. They say they gathered it in an East Oakland church, but what they don't tell you is that the service was run by the Nation of Islam. And Keith Muhammad of Oakland Mosque 26B said that the man who killed the police, quote, "We see our young brother first as a brother. We can't do anything for him. We need to think about what we can do for the living." Isn't that nice? Poets read in San Fran, in Oakland. A poet, "What my dog lets out of his behind after a bad meal is better than most of the poetry those idiots write, those sub-morons. Speakers remember the vermin killer as an intense and animated storyteller and his for his big smile." That's the man who assassinated four policemen.
Savage.
I really want to hear a little more of Jackie Kennedy's voice. Can I hear a little bit of that lilting, incredible? What I like most about Jackie Kennedy's voice, not only is it feminine, I mean, it melts you down. She's so sweet, it's unbelievable. But this was a woman who was like, what do they call that, the Steel Magnolia type? You know, don't assume that a woman who speaks like that is necessarily weak. She understood what she was doing, obviously, but it's so incredibly soothing to hear a woman speak like that compared to these hard you-know-whats today. Man! What are women always trying to, like, be cocky and compete with men? You know, be, yeah, oof. But you hear that sweet voice, and I love the New York accent underneath it. I really love that New York thing about Jackie's voice. It is so unbelievably beautiful. Let me hear a little Jackie for a minute.
"And then this tablecloth is new. It's a gift to the White House from the firm of Porto. And it's all embroidered
this
in
tablecloth
gold to
match the funny, wait a minute. See, when I talk like that, you think that I'm low class or have a New York accent. She speaks with the same accent. This tablecloth. Don't you understand this is how New Yorkers speak? This tablecloth. Even my children laughed at me. They grew up in California. They get a kick out of my New York accent. They don't understand that just because you speak with a New York accent doesn't mean that you're low class. I mean, you could be low class. So what? That's better than being high class today. Take a look at the high class people in the banking industry, what they did to the country. Speaking of high class, low class... I told you I bought a life ring when I was in Florida from the HMS Sheffield. I still don't know whether it was from the one sunken from the Falklands in 82. Could be a real one from the original HMS Sheffield, which was a World War II era light cruiser that was used in World War II by the British, which was never sunk. It was a light cruiser. Of course, in San Francisco, we have a lot of light cruisers in the streets that are not even World War II vintage. They were created after the Vietnam era, but lots of light cruisers around San Francisco. In fact, there was a heavy cruiser in San Francisco who was now in the federal pen for passing child porn around on the Internet. He was a real talk show. And actually, some people said he was such a heavy cruiser, he boarded on being a carrier, but we can't speak about his medical condition. And there are quite a few rear admirals in San Francisco as well, by the way. 1-800-449-8255, Indianapolis. Michelle, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael, I think you're being a little too kind to Michelle Obama. I really don't think she weighs 137. I think she's about 160.
Oh, yeah, I try not to mock women's weight because that's a sensitive issue for many women.
I agree with you about Jackie's voice. It's great. I'm glad you played that again. She's got
It's everyone's forgotten. This woman, although she was obviously, you know, as shrewd as they come and as hard as nails, look who she married, you know, JFK, and then she married Onassis. This woman was tough as can be and probably as smart as anybody. But she was this soft, lilting. I mean, I don't think women could pull it off that kind of thing today. Do you?
No, she showed just a hint of vulnerability, and you just don't get that with Hillary.
Oh, my God. The worst curse that ever hit America was the Year of the Woman in 1994 when they entered Congress. We were told that it would be a kinder, gentler Congress. Just look at Barbara Mikulski.
Right.
All right. Thank you. Is there a kind, feminine woman in Congress? I don't know. Let me hear one more, Jackie. I'm actually having a good time. I'm having a nice time today in the Savage Nation. I hope you are, too. You want to talk about light cruisers, heavy cruisers, carriers, rear admirals, or Jackie? Let's hear Jackie.
Cheers. There are three of them in this room. The two behind us here.
Yes, these two are on loan from the Boston Museum of Fine Art. All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stewart. And then there's Daniel Webster.
I remember when she was around. I really dug her when she was married to JFK. They were like the beautiful couple. I was a young guy. He was a role model for everybody. And by the way, by today's standards, he'd be a raging conservative, incidentally. JFK was a raging conservative Democrat. I don't really care about the affairs. It doesn't matter to me. It means nothing to me. What matters is that this guy was a borders, language, culture American. Take a look at the garbage we've had in America since him. But she was an incredible. I mean, everyone loved both of them. I mean, very few but really sour people who hate everybody couldn't love those two. But what happened was is after he died, and I don't want to go through that. Please, no conspiracy callers. Please don't call about the tower and the watchtower and this, and that, who killed him. I really don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about – then when she married Onassis, I was very upset because he was so ugly, man. I mean, like, here was my first lady – basically lowering herself to this Greek shipping tycoon who looked like, you know, he ran a remnant store in Brooklyn. It doesn't mean he, you know, he was a low class, but, you know, bothered me. I liked the patrician element, the whole Camelot thing of the Kennedys. And then when she went for the money, I didn't like that a lot. You know, that was sad. Then they had terrible tragedy in their lives afterward. When you actually think about it, the Kennedys have had terrible tragedy in their family. The Onassis had a terrible tragedy in his family. I mean, I don't even want to relive it. This woman was almost sort of black widowy in terms of what happened around men in her life, you know. You know about Onassis' son dying in a plane crash. That was the end of Onassis. His heart was broken. His son flew his own plane. The kid was a beautiful, handsome, Greek god type of kid. Flew his own plane. Playboy type of guy. Died in the plane crash. Onassis' heart went out of his body at that point. He never came back from it. Same thing happened to Dean Martin. His son died in Vietnam or in a training incident. He was enlisted in the Air Force. He was training and died. That was the end of Dean Martin. He could never sing again. I mean, these things happen. You know, you read these things. You got to understand life to understand anything about this. Otherwise, you're just dealing in symbolic wordology rather than human beings here. Now, I don't know where you want to go on the show today. I am having a nice time, and I intend to have a nice time. In fact, I may have a nice time for the rest of my life on the radio. Ratings be you know what. But, you know, I want to talk about ratings for a minute. I just got my ratings from the fall book. I'm going to give you one in San Francisco. Despite all of the talk, I beat all of the other talk and news stations in that market. Everybody got beaten to a pulp in the 2554 ratings. You're not going to read that in a local paper because they despise me. They want you to think that I don't exist. But let me tell you something. I made this prediction before, and I'll make it again. I said it about people in the media when I began. I said I'll be on the air long after they're gone. I could count on both hands now how many of them have disappeared, and I'll make the position again. The same people with the people in the business, the newspaper business who hated me, made believe I don't exist, I'll be on the radio long after you're collecting an unemployment check. When you're still collecting your SDSI checks, the crazy checks from the state of California, I will still be broadcasting, giving people news, views, and reviews. I'll make that story up? No, that's a reality. 15 years didn't come from nothing, Buster. San Francisco. Get some Cuban music ready. Indira, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Aloha, or shall I say buenos dias.
How are you? Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for your good comments about Cubans. We have been here 4 years. We love America. We came with the American dream. We hate these Obama maniacs. We hate liberals. We are.
That's right. Tell me what it is about Obama that makes you very nervous in the Cuban community.
You know, I'm very upset because this guy is Marxist. This guy is communist. It's the same rhetoric, the same speeches, the same dreaming words that everybody. I don't know what happened with the people in America.
In other words, he reminds you of the Castro brothers.
Oh, yeah, the Castro brothers, all the communist youth in Cuba. It's crazy.
He's an absolute Marxist. His rhetoric is Marxist. His actions are Marxist. Seizing banks, seizing auto companies is absolutely Marxist. We are watching Marxism emerge in America, and the dummies in the media say, oh, no, it's not happening.
I'm very disappointed with that because I'm meeting Americans that are not the...
But, you know, Indira, I don't want to cut you off, but my other point, I want to stay positive today. I'm in a positive mood. I was making a slightly different point, which is this. Many Cubans came over, about 130,000, in the Mariel boat time, 1980, and 99.9% of them were people like you, your parents perhaps, who were business owners, property owners. They left because the Obama of Cuba, Castro, seized their businesses, seized their houses, nationalized businesses, and they fled to America for a life of freedom. And what Castro did was he released thousands of criminals and perverts from the jails in order to twist the American mind into thinking that all the Cubans who came in the Mariel boat lift were criminals. And the American media, which was largely socialist and today is largely socialist/Marxist, picked up on that, and they lied to the people, making them all look like Al Pacino and Scarface. Play some Cuban music right now, okay? See, when we say Cuban music, we don't play Desi Arnaz. We know the difference here, at least I do. I know everything about everything. Down to even good music. Who's going to know Cuban music today in talk radio? Rush Limbaugh. Get Guy Lombardo if you ask them to play Cuban music. All right, then a one, then a two. All right, leave Rush alone. He's got enough trouble. I like Rush. Actually, out of all of them, I like him the best. Never met him. I've nothing to say against the guy. Levanta. Hey, do you got any Sonora Matancera? That's what I really want to hear. This is Sonora. Okay, hold it. Let's stop for a minute. Most of my audience doesn't know what we're doing. We're talking about this and that. I'm having some fun. I'm into the Cuban thing today because I'm trying to deconstruct the lie about the Mariel boat lift only because we now have Castro brothers running America in the form of Obama, who's lying to the people through his teeth. And I see it. The Cubans see it. Immigrants from Eastern Europe see it. But the dumb American sees nothing, knows nothing, like an idiot walks around, great Obama. But I want to tell you something on a positive note. I got a call the other day from somebody who remained anonymous who said that a lot of the white guys in the brokerage business who voted for Obama are so angry at themselves that they realize who he is, that they were duped. You don't understand that millions of people who never would have voted for Obama had the Republicans not run that moron McCain. They went to Obama because they knew McCain was more of the same jerk that we had in Bush, the same Republican machine. So they said, no more. We'll vote for anybody but him. That's what it was. It was a protest vote. But many of them realized what they did now. And so if that election were reheld today, Obama would lose by 20 points. I'll tell you right now. But that's not going to happen. The question is, will we have another election in 4 years? That's up for grabs. Now, let's get back to the music here on the Savage Nation. I'm not a DJ. I am a JD. And so here we go into the DJ business. A little more Cuban music on the Savage Nation. Come on. Now, can you get another tune other than the same one? I don't happen to like female vocalists in Cuban music. There was one great lady who did it, but she had a voice. Ah, now you're talking about it. Guajira is good. Imagine Sarah Palin running for president. I'd leave the country. That's the best the Republicans could do. I'm out of here. I'll move to Hungary. I'll open up a barbershop. vaya, 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 amigos. Maybe I'll go to Uruguay and open a reptile shop. Maybe Paraguay I can open. Fruit stand in Paraguay. Nightmares about what's coming this month. I'm selling ices in Paraguay. Things go bad after what I've achieved in America. I have to flee to Paraguay. Listen to this voice. I can't explain it, but I'm not going to bother. Play it for a minute. I'll kill the audience. They don't want to hear this. He's telling his story through his singing, right? But this is when it's a simple story. It's always about love and loss, about a woman, mujeres. It's always about a woman. Something about the Latin men are always losing their girlfriends. I don't know what it was, the garlic breath, whatever. I don't know. They're always crying about losing a wife. They're such good lovers. What are the women always running away from them for? I never could figure it out. But the beautiful part is that when they told their stories through ballads, any great singer, there's a way to do it and another way to do it. I'm going to give you one word. Those of you who speak Spanish, you ready for the word? This man sings with a word called duende. D-U-E-N-D-E. Duende. There is no direct translation for the word duende. Duende. It means soul. This man has soul. So you can sing a ballad and not have soul. You can do a talk show without soul and you wind up nowhere. Or you can be Michael Savage where you have brains and soul. Vaya! 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 Bill, go to break.
Más, más, más. La Nación de Savage. Solamente aquí.
And Mrs. Kennedy, on that fireplace, just under the mantel, there's an inscription which I found one of the most moving things in the White House.
Yes, that's from the very first letter that was ever written from the White House. It was written by John Adams, the first president to live here, to his wife Abigail, when he'd only been here 2 days, in November 2nd, 1800. And in it he says, I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and on all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof. It was Franklin Roosevelt who loved that prayer and had it put on the mantelpiece.
Amazing.
Thank you, Mrs. Kennedy.
See, now that's Jackie Kennedy, and she was, I would say, one of the greatest first ladies in my life. I don't know who really stood up to her. The rest were, yeah, they did the standard, you know, charity work, book, library, and no one paid attention to them, which is not knocking them, but, I mean, what did they really do? This one everyone paid attention to. That woman was a presence. She was a presence. I don't have to knock Michelle Obama to say that Jackie Kennedy was a presence. And I get, let's put skin color aside, if you don't mind. I'd really rather not go there. I mean, Michelle went to Princeton. Jackie went to Vassar. But as I said, mentally, Jackie was raised to be a socialite while Michelle was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. Huge difference, if you don't mind. So let's focus on it, you know. On that, if you want, I knew the women would like this part because one thing I know is how to get the women cume goes up when you start bashing women or supporting women. No, we don't do enough about this. Why can't we talk about first ladies and styles? Isn't that sweet saccharine voice or what? I mean, does it still play? If a woman did that today, would you buy it? Or do you really want a hard, tough chick? Like, you know, chick, like a roller derby chick, you know what I mean? Like it should beat a guy up. So all these years of working out, and I don't know, the food must have changed. Like they look like post-op transvestites. A lot of these women look like post-op transvestites today. I don't understand it. And they're not all into that. A lot of them are normal. I don't get that. Or why? That upsets me. Why do they have to? Why is it when a woman gets gray hair, they have to shave it off and look like they worked in Auschwitz? They look like they worked in, like, Bergen-Belsen. What is that? Look. Who finds that attractive, that the creeps? What's wrong with a little long gray hair? Unless you throw a bottle on it, whatever. Whatever. I don't know what the shaved head is with the women over a certain age. But I'm just rambling on about women now, the media and Michelle. Why? Again, they're comparing her to Jackie. I don't think she's a Jackie. And I don't think she's going to come up to Jackie's charm level, personally. But that's the least of our problems. The bigger problem is that we have a naked Marxist for president here. And anyone who studied history understands this. Europeans understand this. The Cubans understand this. But apparently the American dope doesn't get it. They don't get it. Ben in Chicago, do you get it? Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Mike. As far as the comparison between the two first ladies, I don't think there is much of one. As far as Michelle goes, there's absolutely zero respect that I sense from her towards America or the American people or pretty much anybody else in the world. I mean, you look at the two gifts she got for the prime minister from Britain, gave to his sons, it was, you know, two $499 helicopters she grabbed from the White House gift shop.
Oh, my God. Didn't they remove the bust of Winston Churchill from the White House, these two?
Yeah, they probably threw that on the back of their plane on the way out.
And then she gives the Queen of England an iPod?
Oh.
What is this? Like, it's like a Walmart presidency.
Absolutely.
Who gives the Queen of England an iPod? I never saw anything like this. I mean, it's like a low-rent district White House all of a sudden. Maybe they're, you know, they would give them, like, you know, certain tools for barbecuing in England or what? Like a barbecue set with an apron to the Queen?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, what's next coming from? Well, look, the bigger issue is their politics, which is, it's Castro Prime.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country.
Cheers. There are three of them in this room, the two behind us here.
Yes, these two are on loan from the Boston Museum of Fine Art. All three pictures in this room are by Healy. There's Thomas Jefferson, a copy after Stuart. And then there's Daniel Webster, who didn't live here, but he visited the White House for 40 years. And then the most famous one of all, is this one of Abraham Lincoln, which traditionally always hung in the state dining room. Healy was a contemporary of Lincoln, but he only saw him once, so he painted this picture from photographs.
Different time marches on. Now we have a Marxist and his wife in the White House. It doesn't matter whether you agree with me. You may be a dummy and not even know that it's reality. Cubans know what I'm saying is true. East Europeans who fled communism tyranny know that I am telling you the truth. But the schmucks in the media will deny it. Either they don't know it or they're part and parcel of the same game. Don't you understand that? So that's why I'm talking about it. Don't be bamboozled by this nonsense. They're the Obama. What are they doing in England already? Not even 100 days already. The world traveler. There he is already, from Chicago to England. Right away, he solved all the problems in America, seized the banks, seized the auto industry. Now he's on to Europe. Now let's see if he can straighten Europe out. This guy is a narcissist, a megalomaniac, and a Marxist combined. This is a dangerous man who must be reined in, and only the Democrat Party can rein him in. I told you that the other day. Only the Democrat Party can save America from this man. And I am seeing cracks in the stucco of Obama. I see the cracks in the stucco of Obama. When Steny Hoyer, a certifiable mainstream Democrat, old-line Democrat, says that he doesn't know where Obama got the authority to seize the auto companies, you know that even they, the lifetime politicians, are starting to say something's wrong with this picture. And I warn you, mainstream Democrats, get this character under control while you still can. Now, you know, I told you the other day in the Savage Nation that in 1952, then-President Harry Truman tried to seize the U.S. steel industry because the workers went on strike. He, though, was challenged. It was taken to the Supreme Court, and Harry Truman's power was stopped by the U.S. Supreme Court. Can you explain to me why no one has taken this character to the Supreme Court? He seizes the auto industry. He's going to run a Barney Frank now. He's going to change tires. Obama's going to get under the hood and guarantee he's like Mr. Goodwrench all of a sudden. Why does he just put a mechanics uniform on? And the next day, coming out of the State Department, I'm Mr. Good Obama, and I can guarantee this car. What, are you kidding me? Okay. So that's why I'm focusing on a Michelle versus Jackie thing, trying to, like, put it in context. Now, again, let's put aside race. Let's put aside skin color. Both have good university educations, and both are female. But I think it begins and ends there. Why? Because Jackie Kennedy exuded pride in America. Well, Michelle said the first time she was proud of America was when her husband started to do well in the polls. Jackie Kennedy was raised to be a socialite, while Michelle Obama was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. And while Jackie Kennedy wooed foreign dignitaries, Michelle Obama was booed by foreign protesters. Play See Your Love for a minute so I can catch my breath. Going on to the next story here already. At this moment. I'm going to have a scotch after this show. I drink a lot of scotch, but I feel a sore throat coming. I can't wait for the end of the show. Maybe I should have it during the show and see what happens. I have never had a drink in 15 years during the radio. Never. People say, oh, you must drink and smoke. You have a smoker's voice, drinker's voice. Some people think I'm black. It's amazing. I'm proud of all of it. I mean, I if you love me for a drink, smoke, black, fine. All good. Play it up. Come on. Give him a little slow movement.
I love you.
Quaalude. This was big during Quaalude years. And the drugs were Quaalude. What was tranquilized? Sex was bad. Who knows what went on in this country? Look what we wound up with in the White House. I mean, I can't blame Quaaludes. Don't get me wrong. I'm just thinking out loud for a minute. The mines, though, is what I'm getting at. Half the mines in America were shut down between marijuana and drugs like Quaaludes. That's why the ponytails with the bald head, the hippies, they're running the White House behind them. The white criminal communist bums. So they see, this just came out. It should be on the website, maybe. We'll go. Just came out. Fed sees Madoff mansion take over Florida property. U.S. Marshals swooped in tonight and seized Madoff's $11 million mansion and all of the contents inside. A fleet of marshals and Palm Beach cops descended on the five-bedroom mansion. It's not too big, really. Just before 6 p.m. on the first day of the effort by federal authorities to seize many of assets, blah, blah, blah. Some marshals took phone. We are seizing the house. We're going to secure the premises, said Barry Golden, a spokesman for the U.S. Marshals Service. What a name to be a U.S. Marshal. We have a locksmith on hand. All the locks will be changed. The house will be alarmed and monitored. Golden also said we're going to do a complete inventory of the premises. The action was authorized by a sealed federal court order on Madoff's house. Some of the assets are in Madoff's name, others, including the Palm Beach property, legally belong to his wife, Ruthie Dahl. Ruthie has not been charged in the fraud case. Now, this is the part I like the best. Earlier yesterday, marshals seized Madoff's yachts. How could you call a 1969 55-foot Ribovich a yacht? You know, like, oh, wow, yacht. Anyone who doesn't know boats thinks that's a yacht. What would that bring on the market today? Is there a boat dealer out there? I could look it up on Google. I don't think this boat's worth very much. Okay, how much is a 1969 55-foot Ribovich worth? Boat that age, no value. It's value. I mean, you can't sell it. Would you buy a used yacht that was owned by Madoff? First of all, imagine the lock stains in the salon. You know, there's not enough like floor cleaner to get it out of. How about Ruthie's hair dye in the head there? But put that aside. They also seized the 24-foot motorboat from Marine in the same. Big deal. Seized the 24-foot motorboat. That must be worth $12. Bull is worth $2.2 million? Do you believe that? It says the notorious neat freak Madoff has treated the vessel as if it were made of pure gold. A lot of money was put into maintaining this boat, said Golden. The boat was extremely well kept, extremely clean. The engine compartment was spotless. It looked like somebody took a bottle of was the guy selling the boat already? The U.S. Marshal is rather peddling the boat. He must work for Obama. Another one will take over the boat industry next and tell you that the warranty is good. We're going to guarantee the boat. Is there a boat dealer on the line? The Manhattan U.S. Attorney's Office, which last one to take a guilty plea, blah, 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 but their wish list are made, including his Ruth's $7 million penthouse. These are like code words. A penthouse, that's supposed to get you mad, and Manhattan's Upper East Side, supposed to get you, like, angry. Class anger. A $3 million residence in Montauk, Long Island. Ooh. In Marin County, that's like a bungalow. $3 million residence in Montauk, Long Island is a reasonable bungalow in Marin County. And a $1 million chateau in Cap-d'Antibes on the French Riviera. A $1 million chateau in Cap-d'Antibes is like a two-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bath studio apartment. But all right, everything is valued. Fed sees Madoff man. Is there a boat dealer yet who called? Nobody. Boom. I'll have to go to Cuban music. Would anyone buy that Ribovich from him? I want to know this. Can I ask you something? Why is Ruthie, you don't understand something about this. Florida has a homestead law that says no one can take your house. So something's wrong here. I don't get this because you got to understand this house had to be homesteaded. I'd like to know how the Fed sees this, okay? You know, I mean, Ruthie could probably go to Publix right now and buy some gefilte fish in a bottle if she had the money left for that, along with the hair dye. But I would like to know how they seized the house in Palm Beach if they have a homestead law. Can anyone explain this to me? I want to read this again. Some of the assets are in Madoff's name, but others, including the Palm Beach property, legally belong to his wife, Ruth. Can someone explain to me how they could seize Madoff's house? No matter what he did, the house is homesteaded. No one's calling. All I want to do is talk about it. Michelle. See, I start you off and you can't stop. I start you off and that's the end. You want to talk about Pelosi instead? I don't even want to talk about Pelosi. Talk about class. Oh, that's a real classy broad there. Well, that's top of the line. Lasagna, manicotti, lasagna. Nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with manicotti, lasagna. I respect women who make it. But please don't confuse that with Speaker of the House, if you don't mind. Politics, the woman doesn't know what she's talking about. Like a lunatic asylum every time she talks. She called Barney Frank the congresswoman the other day. Did you hear that one? Do you have that soundbite if they missed it? Get the soundbite where Pelosi calls a congresswoman, Bonnie Frank, congresswoman. Get it ready. Till you get it ready, I can go to the toilet and come back and have a scotch and a soda.
Pleased that because a congresswoman, Chairman Barney Frank has talked about a macro regulator.
1-800-449-8255, Chicago. Denise, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Didn't Jack say I'm the one who accompanied Jackie to Paris?
Thank you.
Didn't Jackie speak four languages, write for papers?
Thank you.
Jackie have beautiful arms?
Wait a minute. You're comparing the arms now of the two women?
Well, that's all we heard about for 3 weeks, their arms.
They ought to go south of the border if they want to start comparing bods.
We
don't get any low. You look, it's like with Hillary, they preserve the lower quarters for her in those pants as the bowling pin look started to become more and more pronounced. Remember?
Yes, sir. Pants.
I mean, I don't want to get like that right now. But the fact is, the media definitely biased this whole thing. The years that Hillary was looking more and more like a 10 pin, suddenly the shots were only from the waist up, the breast up, the neck up. Then after the surgery to the face, she looked good after that. I don't know who did that lift, man. I should look into it. But you never see anything south of the border with Michelle.
Where I come from, we have a saying, a lady is a lady, okay?
Where I come from, we have a statement about ladies that I can't say on the air.
Where I come from.
I'm sorry. All right. No, you're right. She spoke languages. Does Michelle speak more than one language?
No.
She speaks English and she speaks Marx. I'll be right back.
Savage.
I'm very food oriented. So, like, I'm comparing and contrasting the women now, Jackie versus Michelle. But now we're going to go to the menu for tonight's dinner that Obama's having with the G20 leaders. I love these menus. They're so pathetic. London, England, celebrity chef Jamie Oliver, yeah, right, will serve a dinner of Scottish organic salmon. Woo, that's rare. Welsh lamb and a traditional Bakewell tart for G20 leaders. Now, we don't know if the Bakewell tart is a lady from one of the side streets for the leaders, but I don't know. I never heard of a Bakewell tart. Traditional ingredients and recipes inspired from England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and the Channel Islands for the dinner at 10 Downing Street. Oliver will cook the meal along with a team of young chefs from the Apprentice program at his London restaurant. Because some guests have special dietary requirements, Oliver said he'll be offering vegetarian options. Isn't that touching? Oh, that must be the Obama people. They don't want to eat an actual salmon. Baked Scottish salmon with seashore vegetables, broad beans, herb garden salad, mayonnaise and wild garlic-scented Irish soda bread. I hate soda bread. I had it in an Irish pub once. I don't know what the big deal is. Full of butter and cream. Yuck. Very high rate of heart attack in Ireland. Vegetarian option. Chilled Wickbury goat's cheese with roast shallots, seashore vegetables, herb green salad, and wild garlic-scented Irish soda bread. No mayo. Ooh. Oh, for the real, the runner, the run, look at the watch. Dead at 33. Give me the media. He'll live to 59, 60. Compared to no mayo, no butter, no meat. They think they're going to live forever. They're going to beat the clock. Slow-roasted shoulder of Welsh lamb, very first of the season, Jersey Royals. That's a potato, by the way. First of the season, asparagus and wild St. George mushrooms, mint sauce and gravy. Vegetarian option, lavage and potato dumplings with first of the season asparagus and wild St. George mushrooms. Hot Bakewell tart, we'll leave that alone again. We had ready, did the Hot Well tart, a joke already. Blah, blah, blah. That's it. They're always bland. It's not my kind of food. I like the Cuban restaurant today better. A grouper. I like broiled grouper, rice and beans. And, the garlic on that. Why don't they eat garlic, these guys? Maybe it would save the world if they all ate some garlic and talk to each other with a little garlic breath after it. You know, like human beings. I got to go to dinner after the show tonight. I got a menu here from a new restaurant someone sent me. Look at this stuff in this. Asian chicken spring rolls. It looks to me like the chicken was probably alive when Mao Zedong was a grandfather. Flash fried calamari. That means, yeah, they beat it to death in China somewhere, froze it, then unfroze it. Defrosted, frozen, and then the runs. Oyster shooter. Who would go in a restaurant and say, give me an oyster shooter? It sounds like they're a dirty thing to order. Oyster shooter. I never heard it. Why can't they just say what you're eating? Here's like something like that. Mahi Veracruzana. I can understand. Grilled fresh Florida mahi, tomato, calamata, olive, caper, and lime. That I understand. What's with an oyster shooter? Tilapia. That's like pond grown. That's the worst. Tilapia, never eat that. Never eat. Grilled Scottish salmon. That would be for Madoff. That would be for Madoff, Scottish salmon. Served with roasted vegetable ratatouille. Tutui. Chilean sea bass. I don't like Chilean sea bass. It must be I don't know. I don't even like Alaskan sea bass. It's too white fishy for me. It's like falls apart like as a fish. It's a fish that should leave it alone already. Filet mignon, never touch the stuff. Chicago ribeye, New York strip, frog legs, that's sad. Only the French could find some. Frog legs, I don't know. How could you not feel bad for the frog when you eat that? Well, I understand. So you eat a chicken, it's the same thing. But lately, I can't even eat a chicken. I'll tell you why. My dog is only 11 pounds. What's shocking to me is that my dog's like hindquarter, I looked at it the other day when he got wet and he jumped in. I looked at his leg. It looked like a large chicken leg. I got frightened. So I said, how could you eat a chicken and savor it? And the dogs, I can't do it. And I say, then your mind starts running. If you have a kaleidoscopic mind like I do, like what if you were starving? Would you eat Teddy? Don't even think about it. I mean, you think about it. Would you roast him? How would you eat him? Stop it. Your mind starts working on you. You know, you're starving. It's you and Teddy. When are you going to die anyway? Would you roast him? Would you cook him? Would you eat him? Would you eat him raw? Oh, stop it, man. But your mind starts going there. Am I the only one who thinks this way?
Savage.
Through sarcasm and humor today, I've been talking about the compare and contrast Jackie versus Michelle, you know. And I would think that, you know, Michelle is a good lady, I'm sure, but she's very, very different than Jackie in so many ways. And the primary way is Jackie was steeped in Americana, American history, and proud to be an American. I can't say that I believe that's true for Michelle. I think she still has a very deep militant streak. I think she still has that whole 60s minority attitude towards white America. I'm sorry, that's the way it looks like to me. And it's not only because I believe that. Look at the actions of the woman and what she said. Now, we're also talking about two things to do with Madoff. Tonight, actually, as I speak with you, federal marshals and Palm Beach police locked up Madoff's house and the contents and his boat, the Bull, which is a 1969 Ribovich. I don't understand what that boat's worth. So I asked two questions because there are two things that are outstanding in my mind. I'm sure for the audience, if you think about these things, they would be questions for you, too. For example, Florida is a homestead state, meaning you can homestead your property. How could they seize Ruth Madoff's house if it's a homesteaded property, number one? I have an answer on that. Someone's calling. Then I ask for a boat dealer to call and tell me what a 1969 Ribovich yacht would be worth. And I'm going to get those answers in a moment right here in the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. These stories and more can be found on michaelsavage.com. Kansas City, Gary, you are a retired boat dealer. What is a 69 Ribovich worth in your estimation?
Well, Michael, first I'd like to say it's a pleasure to talk with you. I listen to you all the time. It's my first time calling.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's pronounced Ribovich as opposed to Ribovich.
Yes.
A Ribovich is built in Palm Beach. It is a handcrafted yacht fishing boat. It takes a couple of years to get one if you go and order it. And it is like a Stradivarius violin. I can't believe that Madoff would have neglected it, and I'm sure it's in pristine condition, and they are just classic. They are just unbelievably beautiful.
All right, what is it worth today? What would it be worth, a boat like this?
I would say 56 feet.
Yes.
Yeah, 56-foot Ribovich in pristine condition would be worth a couple of $1 million all day long.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding.
Even in this market when they can't sell boats to anyone?
It's a Ribovich.
I understand what you said, but even in this market, I said, where boats are not selling at all. I mean, there are manufacturers of high-quality yachts who cannot sell them, and dealers are going bankrupt.
Well, a new yacht is different than buying a classic yacht. Somebody wanted.
Well, I understand that. I understand the difference between a classic automobile and a modern automobile, but nevertheless, there's a very limited market for this kind of boat, wouldn't there be?
No, because people who have money would want a Ribovich.
Hold on. Let's stop for a minute. People with money could buy a new Ribovich, couldn't they?
Well, but they would have to wait a couple of years and would pay many more millions for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
a boater. I would never buy a boat like that. I don't care how good it is, because a boat is a boat is a boat, no matter how good it is. The maintenance on a boat, no matter how good it is, 1969, this boat, especially a Madoff boat, I don't know. You think it'd be worth more or less with his name attached to it?
Well, I don't think that would have much bearing on it, but the yacht itself, believe me when I tell you, Michael, Ribovich.
Well, you know what? You know more about that than I do. I would never buy the boat, but maybe there are people who would buy the Stradivarius of the water. Thank you for the call. I heard of the boat. Where I come from, it's called Ribovich. Okay, you say rye, I say rib, but okay, some like it. Ketchup, catsup, whatever. Now, I have a bigger question. How did the feds, and this should affect anyone listening to the show, should be of interest to you. Florida is a homestead state. One of the few states that says if you homestead the house, it cannot be seized. How could the federal government take Madoff's house? I don't care who he is, what he did. How could they do this? Chicago, Craig, you have an answer. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, Michael. I speak with you. I'm an everyday listener.
Thank you, sir.
As I understand that law,
While there is a homesteader's law there, it does not hold up if you acquired that home by ill-gotten means. Meaning,
okay, if the house was gained, I do recall reading that. If the house was gained through illicit activities, the homestead law does not apply. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay, but hold on now. The Madoff's lawyers could easily argue that although my client has been involved in a fraud, we admit that, this house was purchased with legitimate dollars. In other words, they could easily appeal this one.
Right. And that would assume they would follow the paper trail. But if the government...
I see. In other words, where did the money come from at the time it was bought? And it doesn't matter under whose name, where did the money come from? Let's say Ruthie bought it. Big deal. So where'd she get the money from? She wasn't working in the Macy's tie department. You know, maybe she was working in the Macy's tie department. I don't think she could have made that kind of coinage to buy that joint. But okay, the shows you, because I do remember now during the drug dealers, the age of the big drug things in the 80s in Florida, feds seized the cars, boats, houses, and many of them were homesteaded, you know. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com is the whole deal here. Let's talk about the gifts that the low-rent Obamas gave to the Queen. Because there's something telling about giving the Queen of England an iPod. What do they think? She's like a child who wanted an iPod? What is with these people? This is like the Walmart presidency. Who gives the Queen of England an iPod? I've never seen anything like this. Something's wrong with that picture. The gifts alone tell you that we have something wrong with the picture. Right or wrong? New York, Dave, WOR, go ahead, speak. You're on the Savage Nation.
Michael, when you buy a gift for somebody that you really care about, you put a lot of thought and consideration into it. You do the exact opposite when you don't care about somebody.
You mean a throwaway thing that someone had on the plane, you give them an iPod in a package?
Right.
What is with these people? They have no concept of protocol? Before Brown came to the White House, they took down the statue of Winston Churchill who saved the British from Hitler? That was their idea of a great thing to do?
The DVDs and the iPod are symbolic, saying that you're no longer friends of ours, and we have new friends in town, the Chinese, the Cubans, the Iranians.
You mean if he goes to Cuba and he gives them some big gift, we'll know that that's the whole thing, the whole new world order?
It seems that way, Michael. I mean, America's
got to... Who gives the Queen an iPod? I never saw anything like this. They're treating her like some cheap child that they met in the gutter. Well, I don't know. Something's wrong with this picture. Can anyone explain to me why Michelle and Barack would give the Queen of England an iPod? What is this about? It makes no sense to me. Maybe it is a slap in the face. I don't know. Look, I'm not a big gift giver. I don't even like to receive gifts. They make me uncomfortable. I don't know what to do. Anyone buys me clothing, what do you wear? I'm not one that anyone could buy anything from. Very difficult to begin with. Even as a child, I was uncomfortable with gifts. I didn't know what to do with them. It's a certain skill, to be honest with you. You ought to be, thank God I'm not president. What I'm liable to give the... If I were president, I wouldn't know what to give the Queen. What to give us, like an antique bobsled from Vermont? A pair of Bonnie Frank's undershorts enshrined in plastic? I wouldn't know what to give the Queen of England. So in that sense, But I'm not the president. I'm a talk show host. They're supposed to know. They're knowing how to do these things. I'm not knocking the gay lifestyle. But they know about gifts and protocol, you know, like... You don't bring them an iPod. I mean, that really is weird. I'm the kind of guy, like, I give away things that people give me to someone else. I have to admit that. I told you that already. I admitted that a long time ago. People give me, like, a gift package from Oregon with, like, cheese and crackers, wine that you would never drink. And he's laughing. I'm sorry. I just got one from the syndicator to congratulate me in 15 years in radio. Unopened, in the box. It's going out to someone for Thanksgiving in my family. Who I don't like. No. Someone gets an... Oh, if they get an auto wreck, they'll get it sooner than Thanksgiving. I'm sorry. I think I gave that gift to them 2 years ago after they had given it to me 4 years ago. It's like a chain gift. It keeps coming back. You ever drink wine from one of those packages? Forget about it. It's awful. Yeah, let's have a bottle of wine from a cheese and cracker package. And I remember the years I was young. Like my parents didn't know food, you know, he was an immigrant. They did the best they could, but their idea of like go a party, like they put on a party, they got like a gift platter from a delicatessen wrapped in orange cellophane. It was instant cancer, heart attack. It was like disease in a platter, but it was disguised in orange cellophane. They didn't know any better. They weren't trying to hurt anybody. Fetid corned beef with so much fat in it that even the cow wanted to die. You know, it was that kind of, everything was bad in it. The pastrami, there was a salt lick in there that even a mariner who was dying with. Michelle, you just want to talk about that. Can we change already? No. Gifts are embarrassing. West Virginia, Renee, welcome to the Savage. Now, you're calling about the Obama's gift to the Queen?
The gift to the Queen and also the gifts that they gave to the Browns when they came to our country.
What did they give the Gordon Brown family?
The stack of DVDs.
Oh, my God. This is a real cheap rent operation here.
Kids,
just like a Walmart presidency here.
Kids got the little toy helicopters, but... It just...
Wait. They gave who the toy helicopters?
I think they had two little boys.
Okay, that's really classy. They give two little royal boys or whatever a little toy helicopter, like they couldn't find it in England. That's real American. Even Vermont maple syrup would have been better, like little jugs of maple syrup, right?
Absolutely.
Something American. A little toy helicopter probably made in some outreach of Naples in the Camorra district. But what do you think about giving somebody an iPod?
No thought.
I don't know. I just don't understand that one. I really don't understand if it's a symbol or they're careless individuals. They don't know what they're doing and they're running as fast as they can. What do I know? Marissa in San Francisco, one last thing on the gifts that they gave the Queen an iPod. What is this? Stupidity, carelessness, or a symbol of their disrespect for the Queen of England? I'm not a big fan of the Queen of England, by the way. I'm not a royalist, by the way, nor am I an anti-royalist, but I'm not into the whole royal thing. To me, that kind of inheritance I could do without. Because the prince with the big ears, schmuck, where is he today, by the way? I mean, Obama's there. Where is he? Painting somewhere? Saving the world? I don't know. I'll tell you exactly where this came from in me. And I have to admit, it's my father, he basically poisoned the well with regard to Prince Charles, because this goes back to my childhood. My father, being a Russian immigrant, hated royalty, hated kings, just hated the whole royal thing, didn't like it, and he imbued that in me of distaste for the inherited, not that, you know, in America you should inherit wealth, it's different. We're talking about inheriting and doing nothing with your life and becoming basically a wastrel is what he was talking about. And to him, he said, look, he used to look at even when he was young, the Prince of Wales, whatever his name is, I forget, the one with the big ear, he fell off a horse, married one woman, cheated on her with someone with a horse face. I mean, he had a beautiful wife. He didn't stoop her. And he cheated on her with someone who looked like a nightmare. What was that all about? No wonder she ran away with the Arab who wound up with the car and the death in the tunnel because they almost married, had a Muslim, half-Muslim child. So the MP5, whatever, MI5 had to knock him off because they didn't want a Muslim ascending to the throne. We know the story. You analyze. You understand everything. You're a little while, you talk to you, and you figure it all out. You don't need to go to school to figure these things out. You just need a brain. But what I'm saying is a little different. What is this all about? You have a guy with ears. He would say to me, look at him. He would say, it'll amount to nothing. I said, Dad, why do you say that? He said, look at the ears. You could tell it's an inbreeding. He also hated inbreds. Inbreds, yeah. I said, what's inbreeding? I didn't even know what inbreeding was. He said, when cousins marry cousins, which is forbidden in most societies, they inbreed, and recessive genes click together and produce the Prince of Wales. And that is why societies don't want, you know, inbreeding. They don't want you to marry your first cousin, for example. So I said, how does that apply to the prince? He said, amongst royalty, they marry, they usually bang the cousin or whatever. That's all they can get because they're not allowed outside the castle. They play with the cousins. You know? They're looking already with the tacks and the dominoes on the carpet. They're looking at them. And then before you know, no one stops them because they're all whack jobs anyway in the royal department. They're all crazy. They all do each other. So that's how he winds up with the ears. And he said, it'll amount to nothing. Look, and what has he done? Environmentalist. Paints pictures like a woman up there on the. He doesn't mean if you paint, you're womanly. This one, though, paints pictures that look like some sad woman in a, you know, on Milltown in the 50s would paint this kind of pictures. I'll be right back. Leave me alone. Savage. Michelle versus Jackie, Bernie's boat goes bye-bye, conservative talk radio, Michael Savage. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm having a wonderful time today. I give you my loyalty. I give you my professional best. And if I can illuminate the dark story of Marxism around the world and the complex story of the evolution of Marxism in the American political system and how we have an open Marxist in the White House, I will tell you that I more than repaid for my devotion to this story by your loyalty, my audience of the Savage Nation, because that's about all I can say to you right now. And that's why I do it. I mean, I love that I was blessed with a sense of humor, and I know I get a little crazy sometimes like I did in the last hour, but I love it. I love playing the scales of my mind, and I hope you enjoy that as well. And I know many of you do, and many of you wait for the days that I get into these moods. But can't do it every day. Some days I can, some days I can't. But weaving in and out of the storytelling with the humor is a great way to make a living. I got to tell you that, especially when you believe in what you're saying. I'm also finding a very deep sore throat, which I got to tell you, I have very many different home remedies for. Throat lozenges. Please don't call with any. The zinc lozenges are good. I got an echinacea spray that works. But I'll tell you right now, as this hour draws to a close and I have another hour to go, I have a very, very fine scotch. And I never drink on the air. You're listening to a memorable show right now. I'm not going to drink. I'm going to actually gargle a scotch. Oh, that was good in the back. It was taught to me by a non-drinker. The guy's 86, survived World War II, hid inside the belly of a cow in a barn while the 88-millimeter shells were coming in from the Germans in outside the forests of the Ardennes Forest. He told me when those shells came over his head, he thought railroad cars were flying over his head. I said, "How'd you survive it?" He said to me, "There was a dead cow in the barn." He said, "I crawled into it, blood and all." And he said, "I survived and some of the men around me didn't." I said, "Oh, my God, that took guts." I mean, okay, it's a play on words. But that did take guts. He had to, literally had to swim in the guts of a dead cow. But when you think about it, it's an interesting story. I mean, it was probably the moisture, the liquid, rather, and the organs that created a further barrier than just the sinews and the bones of the cow. A horrible story. But what you have to do when you have to survive is one thing compared to what you do on a daily basis. You know, like there's a show in the America's Dirtiest Jobs. Ugh, never do it. Believe me, you do a lot of things if you have to. Okay, I found that a long time ago. You do things you don't want to do. You go into depths in your own being you don't want to go to, and you have to go there, you go there. That's all. The human being is an amazing organism, and we're capable of much, much more than we think we're capable of. And America's certainly capable of a better president than this, and we're capable of better leadership than we have in Congress, and we're certainly capable of pulling ourselves out of this hole we're in. And it requires belt tightening and living a little bit more like your parents did in the 50s or 60s than today. That's all. It's the end of the story. And the country will come back together. The excess, you know, you drive around, you look. I'm going on and on now with this rant, but I got to tell you the truth. It's an important one to me. When you think about it, the economy is retracting. What does that actually mean? How about all of the last 10, 15 years car lots in America? I would drive by and say, this is insane. Who's going to buy this inventory? What does everyone need a new car every year for? You don't need it. First of all, the cars are better today. American cars are as good as any in the world. Don't believe the propaganda. You got to understand, the Japanese buy magazines. They buy writers. They tell you they're better. But if you actually study the data, American cars today are as good as Japanese. They're all produced to the same standards. So you should buy American. That's number one. Number two, the cars are so good, they last 4 or 5 years without breaking down. They're little perfect computers with tires. And so that's number two. So what do you need? All these cars there. When I watch them coming in, where the ships and are coming through the Golden Gate, and I see these car ships from Toyota, whatever. Who's going to buy these cars? The lots were overflowing. Now you drive past dealerships, of course, and they're like ghost towns. It's frightening, but what do you think's happening here? Retracting. The market is going to find itself. Supply and demand. The old laws of supply and demand are kicking in. I'll give you an example of an auto dealer. There's a little English manufacturer called Morgan. Morgan was built in the 30s, actually started in the 20s by the grandfather. And then it was, I once had a Morgan, a used Morgan. It was an unbelievable car with wooden frames and a powerful engine twin four-barrel car. One of my greatest memories to this day is racing in a light snow through Central Park when I was young. Okay, I was stupid, had a couple of drinks with my friends, maybe more than a couple of drinks. And I raced that Morgan through all gears through Central Park one midnight. In a light snow. Okay, you do crazy things when you were a kid. I didn't hurt anybody. I didn't run over a horse. Now, Morgan was a brand like that Rybovich. You know, custom built. People wanted it. And there was always a market for it. Then what happened was the market started to retract. So the Morgan family, the young guy who took it over, did something very clever. He reduced production. He didn't keep producing more to sell more. He reduced production and he maintained his company. And I think that's what American auto manufacturers have to do. Instead of having Barney Frank under the hood and Obama as Mr. Goodwrench, just produce fewer cars. Supply and demand, the rules of supply and demand. This has been a heck of a great show. I really thank you for listening. Another big hour right here on the Savage Nation. Be here.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Talking about today on the Savage Nation. The media and Michelle Obama. Once more, the media is going gaga, 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 gaga over Michelle Obama. They're calling it Michelle Mania. Oh, I don't know who's calling it that. The British, in between bouts of drunken degeneracy and puking on themselves on car fenders, are singing her praises as well. But does she really live up to the high standard that Jackie Kennedy set for first ladies well over 40 years ago? I'll let you decide. Who do you think is a better role model for the girls and young women of today, Michelle Obama or Jackie Kennedy? We also talked about Bernie's boat going bye-bye. Bernie Madoff's boat, the Bull, was confiscated in Palm Beach today. But Ruthie and the boys, Marky and Andrew, are still free. Is it right that Bernie should get a nice big jail cell all to himself? Or shouldn't it be all in the family? And, of course, conservative talk radio is skyrocketing. We talked about that. While the midstream media is pushing leftist pabulum, conservative talk radio is doing better than ever. My ratings are really very high. They're higher than ever. Why do you think the Savage Nation and other conservative shows are doing well in such dark times? Obama's latest European tour is being overshadowed by a rift forming between our allies and the U.S. over how to handle the current world financial crisis, Afghanistan, and Iran. While Obama seems more interested in talking to Russia and China, our next guest, Niall Gardner, says that the president needs to protect our transatlantic alliance.
Barack Obama began his first overseas trip as president when he arrived in London. He is meeting British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Conservative Party leader David Cameron, and Queen Elizabeth II before attending the G20 summit on April 2nd. He then travels to Strasbourg and Kiel, in France and Germany for the 60th anniversary NATO summit, followed by meetings with European Union leaders in Prague. His European tour concludes on Monday and Tuesday with a visit to Turkey. The president's trip to Europe has been heavily overshadowed by a major transatlantic rift over U.S. calls for Europe to pledge significantly more funds for a global stimulus package, a proposal that has been strongly resisted with good reason by most European leaders. There are already signs that the Obama administration will back down in the face of intense European opposition when world leaders meet at the G20, with many decisions likely to be postponed for a future meeting. The G20 aside, this trip will be an important opportunity for the new president to demonstrate clear U.S. leadership in Europe on an array of key issues, including the war in Afghanistan, the Iranian nuclear crisis, and the broader transatlantic alliance. President Obama must also confront a resurgent Russia over NATO expansion and third-site missile defense, as well as the continuing threat posed by Islamist terrorism. On Afghanistan, alongside the British Prime Minister, President Obama must call on European allies to help bear the military burden of the fight against the Taliban by sending more combat troops to the battlefields of Helmand Province and by removing the dozens of caveats aimed at keeping their personnel out of harm's way. On Iran, President Obama should declare that the West will not accept the ugly specter of a nuclear-armed Tehran and will do all in its power, including the possible use of force as a last resort, to prevent it from becoming a reality. It is vitally important that President Obama preserve the Anglo-American special relationship.
Has this administration handled our transatlantic alliance as well?
While wooing strategic competitors such as China and Russia, the new U.S. administration has been largely indifferent to the Anglo-American alliance, with an appallingly handled reception for the British Prime Minister when he visited the White House in early March, and the recalibration of the special relationship as a special partnership. Even a bus of Sir Winston Churchill was unceremoniously thrown out of the Oval Office. A distinctly undiplomatic State Department official involved in the planning of the Obama-Brown meeting was quoted as saying that there's nothing special about Britain, you're just the same as the other 190 countries in the world. That is a huge insult at a time when there are nearly 9,000 British soldiers fighting on the battlefields of Afghanistan. Indeed, it would be a huge mistake for the new US administration to look away from Britain for its most important strategic relationship. There has scarcely been a more important period since the Second World War for joint US-British leadership, with a major war in Afghanistan, a global battle against Al-Qaeda, an increasingly aggressive Russia, and the prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran. The special relationship is vital to American and British interests on many levels, from military, diplomatic, and intelligence cooperation to transatlantic trading ties. If President Obama does not invest in the preservation of this relationship, the end result will be a weaker United States that is less able to stand up to terrorism and tyranny and to project power and influence across the globe.
What does Obama need to do in England?
When he visits London, it is imperative that President Obama acknowledges and pays tribute to the tremendous sacrifice of Britain's armed forces alongside American troops in both Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as two world wars, something he has never done in a major policy speech. Great Britain is America's most reliable friend. As nearly every post-war president has found, there's simply no alternative to US-British leadership in securing the free world. President Obama should maintain the Anglo-American special relationship as the centerpiece of the transatlantic alliance. At the same time, the United States should be wary of backing a federal Europe. Obama heads across the Atlantic as the leader of the first U.S. administration to wholeheartedly back the creation of a federal Europe. In contrast to early U.S. administrations, including those of George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, the Obama administration is avowedly Euro-federalist in its outlook and is keen to help build a European Union defense identity as well as support the foundations of a European superstate in Brussels. The Bush administration was sharply divided over Europe. Although then-Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice backed the European Constitution, her pro-Brussels instincts were strongly opposed by key figures in the White House and the Pentagon. President Bush himself worked hard to build up a counterweight to the Franco-German axis, one comprised of pro-American nations among the new EU members of Eastern and Central Europe. In contrast, President Obama's government is strongly backing the European Security and Defense Policy, the Lisbon Treaty, and the Common Foreign and Security Policy. Obama will seek to strengthen French and German leadership at the heart of a united European Union.
What has Obama already done to show his support for a federalized Europe?
President Obama has appointed several prominent supporters of Euro-federalism to key positions in the Pentagon and State Department, including the new Undersecretary of Defense for Policy and the next Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. The Obama administration has already made concessions to Paris over President Sarkozy's decision for France to rejoin the NATO Integrated Command Structure. The French have been given two major positions at the helm of the alliance, a move that will significantly enhance the drive towards a European defense component within NATO. This dangerous shift in U.S. policy is a betrayal of both U.S. and British interests that will threaten the long-term future of the U.S.-UK special relationship, weaken the NATO alliance, and undermine the defense of British sovereignty in Europe. It will also undercut opposition across the EU to the Treaty of Lisbon, including in countries such as Ireland, Poland, and the Czech Republic, and may set the scene for a major confrontation between the Obama White House and a future Conservative administration in London. When he visits Europe this week, President Obama has a major opportunity to show that he has the maturity, strength, and conviction to lead on the world stage. He must project a clear vision for U.S. global leadership, one that is anchored firmly in the transatlantic alliance with Britain. The Obama administration currently lacks a clear foreign policy direction, and against the backdrop of an increasingly dangerous world, America seems rudderless and at times unwilling to lead. Washington must stand up to the Iranian nuclear threat, the resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan, the global menace of Al-Qaeda and Russian intimidation in Europe with strength, resolve and conviction. This must include a willingness to wield maximum force where necessary, deploy a comprehensive missile shield in Europe and increase military spending in the defense of the United States and the free world. The president must be careful not to fall into the trap of undermining America's most important alliances, including the US-UK special relationship and NATO, by supporting the rise of a federal Europe. There is no evidence to suggest that Europe is capable of shouldering the burden of global leadership with America. The European Union is a grandiose emperor with no clothes, and its track record in confronting dictatorial regimes such as Iran has been a dismal failure. The EU is obsessed with challenging American global preeminence rather than working with the United States, and the European project is ultimately all about building a counterweight to American world leadership. As they approach the transatlantic alliance, President Obama and his aides should heed the advice of a former British Prime Minister and great friend of the United States who fought to defend the special relationship and maintain British sovereignty in Europe. As Margaret Thatcher put it, that such an unnecessary and irrational project as building a European superstate was ever embarked upon will seem in future years to be perhaps the greatest folly of the modern era.
Thanks, Niall. This is a time that the world needs strength and leadership. I'm not sure Obama is ready for it, but let's wish him well. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Here's what's on America's favorite website, the site with those pictures, michaelsavage.com. G20 protesters jam London and storm the Bank of Scotland. Ho-hum, another protest by another group of left-wing gaggle. Erasing the Thin Blue Line, Savage Sounds the Alarm by Barbara Anderson. Incredible. Obama plans a key role in naming the GM board. Maybe Barney Frank can change tires. From the Associated Press, stimulus dollars that will be released for schools. Is the drug cartel using bogus FBI bulletproof vests? Is that true? Read the Houston Chronicle on michaelsavage.com. Steny Hoyer, a Democrat and a left-winger at that, says, I don't know where Obama got the legal authority for the auto plan. Well, that's interesting. Why doesn't someone take it to the U.S. Supreme Court? From the London Times on michaelsavage.com, North Korea threatens to shoot down U.S. spy planes ahead of a missile launch. Unbelievable. From the AP, a woman kills a neighbor over a barking dog. Well, I can relate to that. I wouldn't kill someone over it, but hey, what are you going to do? The woman needs her sleep. Obama's aunt, the illegal alien from somewhere in Africa, is allowed to stay another year, at least the next year, if she waits a chance to make a case before an immigration judge. Maybe she could be made Secretary of State. From the Jerusalem Post, we read that Hamas is planning a military college to train commanders. Maybe Obama's stimulus money can be used to create the Taliban U. Wait. Oh, and by the way, a federal judge, so-called, ordered the U.S. to release a prisoner from the Guantanamo Detention Center into the United States. Let's hope he winds up in a liberal's backyard. You do know that Bernie's boat goes bye-bye. The bull was confiscated in Florida. The truth is, though, you know, used yachts today are near worthless. You can just imagine what that pig is worth. It's all a window dressing. You know, the government seizing Bernie Madoff's boats. Big deal, window dressing. Why don't they seize his apartment? And why don't they seize Ruthie's jewels and assets and the boys Mark and Andrew and the grandchildren, their assets? You know, forget the window dressing. Typical government window dressing. Recently, I was in South Florida, by the way, speaking of Bernie Madoff. And speaking of boats, and I went into an antique store, used furniture, used this. I told you my dad was in a business, so once in a while I love to go into consignment shops. You don't know what you're going to find, particularly in South Florida today. You can find anything. It was mainly dreck, you know. It's sad you go in those stores, you see tables and chairs that your grandmother must have had. They look like funeral home, you know. It's like, ugh, you know, sad. You could see they had candy on it and that kind of thing. I don't mean they're bad people, but I found something you're never going to believe, which I bought and brought home to my studio. It's a life ring from the British warship, the HMS Sheffield. Now, it looks like an original. I mean, I'm not going to ask the antique guy if it's original. What do they know? It looks to me like it is because it's not plastic, and it's an original life ring from the British ship HMS Sheffield. And this is interesting. Would you stop ringing in here? Interesting. In the studio, ringing, dinging, things going on, like around the clock. So I bought the HMS Sheffield life ring. I paid very little money for it. And then I bought a wooden wheel from an old ship. I know I can tell it's an old ship wheel, not a repro. I put it in my studio. My studios look like old bars in North Beach used to look. artifacts, things hanging from the ceiling, from the walls, on the floor. It's a place that's, you know, it reflects my interest. So, and it makes sense because I bought the Life Ring in South Florida, and I said, wait a minute. It must have come from someone from Argentina who picked up the Sheffield's Life Ring when it sank, you know, on the islands, in the islands down there, in the Falklands Islands, and then sold it to, who knows, to an antique bum, and the antique this, that. The HMS Sheffield was a British ship sunk in 1982 by an Argentine missile fired from a fighter bomber, and I have the Life Ring from it. Then I ate in a Cuban restaurant recently in South Florida. I got to tell you something. So I go in this Cuban restaurant, small family joint. I had an unbelievable go, about $8.95. I had a piece of grouper fish broiled. I had plantain. They have a sweet one. I said, make it regular. Wait, it gets better. The rice, the beans. And the beans are much better than in the Mexican restaurants, I'm sorry to tell you. I don't know what it is, but the Cubans do it better. In the dish, a plate of garlic, chopped garlic. I didn't have to ask for it like it was some secret, you know, bomb. And chopped onions. I thought I found my homeland. But you know what struck me the most about this Cuban restaurant was a poster that the guy had in the window. It said, family history. And it shows a picture of the whole family, all the girls, all the boys, grandmother and grandfather. And listen to what it says on the bottom. Our deepest gratitude to our loyal customers and this beautiful country for allowing our family to pursue our dreams. So I had to go up to the owner. And I said to him, you have a beautiful family and a beautiful family story. And I got to tell you something. It's nice to see. I said, compared to so many of the immigrants who come in today who have the wrong attitude. He said, you're 100% right about that. Now, here's something interesting. In the family history, it says Mariel Boatlift, 1980, 126,000 Cubans abandoned their communist island in a massive exodus. And this family was one of the families. What you don't know is that the communists and the American media made you think that all of the Mariel Boatlift Cubans were criminals. But 99.9% of them were decent Cubans who lost their businesses, lost their homes to the son of a gun murderer, Castro, the Castro killers. And it is true that Fidel Castro, to poison the well of the decent Cubans who fled the island in 1980, to poison the well and make Americans think all the Mariel boat people were criminals. He threw criminals out of the prisons so that everyone in America would say they're all drug dealers. You have no idea how powerful the communist lobby is in the American media. You think everyone from the Mariel Boatlift was a drug dealer. 99.99% were people like you who are terrified of what's coming to this country. And if you think Castro was not related to Obama politically, you are mistaken. Our deepest gratitude to our loyal customers in this beautiful country, it says, for allowing our family to pursue our dreams. What a beautiful, beautiful thing that is, huh? Anyway, that's the difference here. This is the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage.
It's been 30 years since the Three Mile Island meltdown, the largest nuclear accident on U.S. soil. The incident is often associated with what happened in Chernobyl. Joining us today to shed some light on what actually happened with the two nuclear reactors is Jack Spencer with the Heritage Foundation.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be with you today. This Saturday was the 30th anniversary of that incident, and it's a good time to look back at sort of what happened during the Three Mile Island incident, how that continues to affect our view on nuclear energy today, and also a look at what happened at Chernobyl, because often it's the case that Chernobyl is associated with Three Mile Island. When we look at back at what happened at Three Mile Island, it really wasn't a major accident like we often are led to believe that it was. What happened there was the result of human error. You had a series of events that led to a partial meltdown of that reactor. It led to some radioactive steam being released into the atmosphere. But the reality was no one was ever harmed by that. It exposed the surrounding area population to about the equivalent of a chest X-ray. Studies since the accident shows that there was no harm to any people, wildlife, or plants. And in fact, one of the reactors at Three Mile Island continues to operate today, and many of the people living in the area continue to be very strong supporters of nuclear energy. Nonetheless, that incident really came at a time when the nation was starting to cool on nuclear energy. We had come through the 70s where the anti-nuclear crowd had really begun gaining momentum. The nuclear industry was sort of on the downfall. You had movies like The China Syndrome out there that actually came out right around the time of Three Mile Island. So the Three Mile Island incident really was the nail in the nuclear industry's coffin.
Well, why is that important today?
The reason it remains important today is because as we try to look for new energy sources, we're looking for clean energy, we're looking for affordable energy, and we're looking for domestic energy, Three Mile Island continues to have a lot of impact on people, on how people look at nuclear energy issues. So it's important that we understand that what we're often led to believe happened there didn't, but how it led to some changes in the nuclear industry so that we can be assured that those things don't happen again. As a result of Three Mile Island, new regulations were put into place. The problems that led to Three Mile Island, there were some control issues, some issues with the controls of the reactor. Those have been fixed. Really across the board, different procedures have been put in place so that what happened there would not happen again. And that's why we've not had any more incidents like that. In fact, in the history of nuclear power in the United States, there's never been a fatality as a result, or an injury for that matter, as a result of commercial nuclear energy.
What happened at Chernobyl?
Chernobyl is often associated with Three Mile Island, but it's important to really distinguish between the two. The Chernobyl incident was much more serious than Three Mile Island, but still the results there are often overblown. The reactor at Chernobyl was of a completely different design than what we have in the United States. It was operated not by expert nuclear operators, but instead by engineers who were conducting an experiment at Chernobyl and when that occurred. And what they did in order to conduct their experiment was they turned off all of the safety mechanisms of that reactor. And so when things started to go wrong, there was nothing in place to tell the people that things were going awry, and things quickly spun out of control. Making matters worse in Chernobyl was that the Soviets decided they weren't going to tell anyone that anything really bad was happening. So when fires started and that sort of thing, when the rescue workers came in, they didn't realize they were going to be exposed to high levels of radiation. And of the under than 50 people that actually unfortunately perished as a result of Chernobyl, most of them were those rescue workers. They didn't realize that what they were actually walking into. In terms of the cancers that were caused by Chernobyl, the reality is there were about 4,000 children who did come down with thyroid cancer. 99% of those were resolved favorably. 9 actually and unfortunately did perish. But even those probably wouldn't have happened had the Soviets issued iodine tablets to their population, which again, because they were so secretive, they didn't want to tell anyone that anything was wrong. But nonetheless, that's what happened there. And what we find is that cancers have not resulted from Chernobyl. Those things continue to be studied today. Nonetheless, when we talk about nuclear energy, we're often reminded of the catastrophe that Chernobyl was and that could happen in the United States. And that simply could not happen. The technologies we have here today are totally different than what they had in Chernobyl. The safety mechanisms are totally different. So that's really not something we need to worry about.
Why do you feel nuclear energy is so important? I certainly do.
It is clean energy. It emits nothing into the atmosphere. It's affordable energy. When you look at how we produce energy in this country, coal, natural gas, renewables, and nuclear, we actually get 20% of our electricity from nuclear energy. The nuclear is the least expensive. Now, as we build new reactors, it will be more expensive than existing ones because you got to pay for those capital costs. But it could be a very affordable energy source. Now, in order for it to be successful, however, it's not enough just to snap our fingers and make it so. The problem is that the government's very involved in the nuclear industry. I would argue its involvement inflates the price somewhat. So what we need to do is institute a handful of reforms. We need to reform the regulatory process in the United States. That doesn't mean have less reform or less regulation. It doesn't mean to have weaker regulation. We need to have smarter regulation for nuclear reactors.
What about the issue of nuclear waste?
We need to come up with a mechanism that works for dealing with nuclear waste. And today, dealing with nuclear waste is not a technical issue. The technologies are there to do it. In fact, countries like France and Japan reprocess their nuclear waste. We don't do that here. Instead, in the United States, it's a political issue. The president has said he's not going to support Yucca Mountain, despite all scientific evidence demonstrating that Yucca is a perfectly safe repository. We haven't decided whether or not we're going to recycle the nuclear waste. So these are all things that we need to deal with as a country. And as those issues become resolved, we'll find that nuclear energy may very well help us meet all of the goals that all of us want to meet. We all want cleaner energy. We all want affordable energy. We all want to increase our access to domestic energy. And that's what nuclear power allows us to do. While we should think about what happened at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and learn from them, what we cannot do is allow those incidents to prevent us from moving forward with nuclear energy in the 21st century. And with that, I think that we can move forward. We can make nuclear an important part of how we do energy in this country. And if the politicians would move out of the way, I have every confidence that the private sector can meet that demand and go off and do that.
Thanks, Jack. Nuclear energy seems to be an important part of the plan. If we're going to free ourselves of foreign oil dependence, we can't run everything on banana peels. I started the show talking about Michelle Obama versus Jackie O. Michelle is now in Europe with her husband. The media seems to be trying to make her into another Jackie Kennedy. I think it's quite a stretch. But Jackie lived in another world. It was a world where liberals like her husband still had the guts to stand up to foreign tyrants. It was a world where women were respected, even if they didn't stand up and give hate speeches, as Michelle Obama has done. Let's listen to some music from that era. You know, any rock and roll.
Boom, boom, boom.
It was a world where the chrome was thick and the women were straight. And we had a charming, elegant first lady who impressed the entire world with her grace and charm. Play some rock and roll. But what are the difference between Michelle and Jackie? Well, for one, Jackie Kennedy was born in Southampton, New York. Michelle was born in Chicago, Illinois. Jackie Kennedy went to Vassar and George Washington University. Michelle went to Princeton. Jackie was raised to be a socialite. Michelle Obama was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. Jackie Kennedy wooed foreign dignitaries, while Michelle Obama was booed by foreign protesters. I'm sorry, that's hilariously funny. Jackie Kennedy exuded pride in America, while Michelle Obama said the first time she was proud of America was when her husband started doing well in the polls. So in this corner, we have it 5'7" tall, weighing in at 120 pounds, Jackie Kennedy. And in that corner, we have it 5'11" tall, weighing in at 137 pounds, Michelle Obama. Who will be remembered as the better role model for the girls and young women of America? I'll let the Savage Nation decide. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Fireplace just under the mantle, there's an inscription which I found one of the most moving things in the White House.
Yes, that's from the very first letter that was ever written from the White House. It was written by John Adams, the first president to live here, to his wife Abigail, and he'd only been here 2 days, in November 2nd, 1800. And in it he says, I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and in all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof. It was Franklin Roosevelt who loved that prayer and had it put on the mantelpiece.
Amazing.
Thank
Amazing.
You, Mrs. Kennedy.
See, now that's Jackie Kennedy, and she was, I would say, one of the greatest first ladies in my life. I don't know who really stood up to her. The rest were, yeah, they did the standard, you know, charity work, book, library, and no one paid attention to them. Which is not knocking them, but I mean, what did they really do? This one everyone paid attention to. That woman was a presence. She was a presence. I don't have to knock Michelle Obama to say that Jackie Kennedy was a presence. And I get, let's put skin color aside, if you don't mind. I'd really rather not go there. I mean, Michelle went to Princeton. Jackie went to Vassar. But as I said, mentally, Jackie was raised to be a socialite, while Michelle was raised to be an anti-socialite socialist. Huge difference, if you don't mind. So let's focus on it, you know. On that, if you want. I knew the women would like this part, because one thing I know is how to get the women. The women cum goes up when you start bashing women or supporting women. No, we don't do enough about this. Why can't we talk about first ladies and styles? The newsboys tell us that federal agents in Florida seized Bernie Madoff's boats near Fort Lauderdale. The agents took control of the 55-foot custom boat called the Bull. At a local marina west Palm Beach, they seized Little Bull, a smaller 24-footer. It looks like Madoff's Bull is finally starting to go on the bear. In addition to the two boats, authorities are going after a sport yacht, which is docked in France, real estate in New York, Palm Beach in France, cars, a Steinway piano, silverware and jewelry. But the news did not tell us is whether Ruthie Madoff, Ruthie, who saw Bernie through good times and even better times, will be joining her husband in the pen. So far, she's still allowed to go shopping on Fifth Ave. But what about their children, the good little boys, Marky and Drew? Their assets have been frozen. But when will they be cooling themselves in a family cell? And more to the point, when is the SEC going to be cleared out from top to bottom? Obama promised us an open administration. So when are all the corrupt apparatchiks within the SEC going to be turned out on their ears? When is the SEC employee who was married to Madoff's niece going to be investigated and, if necessary, tried, convicted, and imprisoned? When are we going to see Chris Cox in an orange jumpsuit on his way to a Supermax, not on the Bull? It doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, because in spite of all his promises, the great Obama has a few problems of it of his own. It turns out that just like Geithner and Daschle and a half a dozen others, Obama's Health and Human Services nominee, Kathleen Sebelius, has a tax problem. So Bernie Madoff may have a Bull problem, but it's nothing compared to the Bull coming out of B.O. One of the campaign promises that came from Obama was that he would be able to work with other nations, that he could get more from America's allies, because he would be consulting with them more. Now that he is in London for the G20 summit, we'll get to see just how well he can work with our allies. I hope he does well. Joining us now to talk about Obama and the G20 summit is KT McFarland from ktmcfarland.com.
You know, the next 2 weeks are going to determine Obama's relationship with Europe, at least for the near term. First, we've got the G20 summit, which he's at now, which will be followed by a NATO summit and a meeting of the European Union along with Obama. And this is all in the next 2 weeks. It will be a defining moment and critical in dealing with our economic, political, and military issues. And frankly, it'll also be a referendum on Obama. You know, one of his big campaign promises was that he would be a much better steward of American foreign policy than Bush, who was criticized by much of the world and particularly despised in Europe. Obama's implicit promise was that he could get so much more out of America's allies, especially in Europe, because he would consult with them more and they would like him a lot more. Yet, one of the reasons the Europeans loved Obama is they thought he would consult with them more often, but frankly, they didn't think that he would ask as much of them as Bush did. So these are two very contradictory ideas, and we'll see which one prevails after this trio of meetings in the next few weeks. Will this new era of U.S.-European consultation result in Europe doing less or more for the U.S. and our interests? One of the things to watch in these meetings is the U.S.-German relationship, especially on the economic issues. So far, Europe seems to be siding up into two camps, especially dealing with the global financial crisis. On one hand is the United Kingdom, along with us, which have decided to vastly prime the pumps with massive government spending programs and also to bail out the banks and other industries, as you have so rightly pointed out. On the other hand is the Europeans, especially the economic powerhouse of Europe, which is Germany, which have resisted calls for increased spending. You know, Obama has urged them to do more, but so far they said, hey, you know, we've gone down this road before, nationalizing industries, massive government expenditures, and we don't want to go down it again because it doesn't work.
Well, why should they? It seems we're going to pump money into the system regardless.
With the United States being the world's dominant economy, as long as the U.S. is willing to prime the pump, the Europeans can get a free ride. They'll get the benefit of all that increased stimulus spending without footing any of the bills. So while we and the Brits will incur huge domestic debt to stimulate the economy, The export-oriented Germans, well, they'll get the benefits because they'll see decreased demand for German goods. Their economies will revive, and it's all because of our expenditures. Now, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel and Francis Sarkozy have argued that one of the reasons they can't afford this kind of stimulus spending is their demographics. They have shrinking populations, and if they were to have a long-term debt on a shrinking population, it would be untenable. Well, you know, I guess it makes perfectly good sense from their point of view. But, you know, these are actions Obama's already taken, so they've already got the free ride. They don't need to spend any more on an economic stimulus plan. I mean, Merkel said it very well in an interview with her favorite New York Times, that the international policy is, for all friendship and commonality, also about representing the interests of one's own country. So she gets it. She gets that she's putting Germany first. It's not clear Obama's putting America first. Because, in part, these bank bailouts are also helping the European banks, especially the German banks. The Europeans lent heavily to Eastern European countries, such as Poland and Hungary and the Ukraine. And now that these countries are defaulting, they've turned around and asked the Western European Union to bail them out. But the Germans have blocked the bailouts, arguing that those countries shouldn't turn to the European Union or to Western Europe. They should turn to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which means that the United States, China, Japan, as well as Europe, would foot the bill, even though it's a problem that the Western Europeans have created. In the end, Obama will probably cave to the European demands on these economic issues, since he really has little choice. He's already spent the money. There's no point in the Europeans, especially the Germans or the French, bailing us out of our bailouts. But the question is, what is he going to get in return? Is he going to get something on foreign policy? Is he going to get more cooperation on his just-announced Afghanistan-Pakistan policy? You know, the implication is we should get something for all the spending we're giving the Europeans. But frankly, I think that's unlikely, too. France and Germany are more likely to pull troops out of Afghanistan, not to add to them. They're reluctant to increase any spending to Afghanistan and Pakistan, as has requested, because they've got their own economic troubles. So in all likelihood, Obama, who's made this big announcement of Afghan-Pakistan increasing the theater of the war, he's going to do it really all by himself. In all likelihood, he's going to come home empty-handed, having already allowed Europe to get this huge free ride off of our banks. And, you know, we know Europe is going to be better off for an Obama presidency. The question is, are we going to be any better off with an Obama presidency? We know what they're getting out of it. We're just not sure what we're getting out of it.
Thanks, KT. Obama seems set on spending money, even if we are the only ones, and even if we go broke doing it. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.